Okay, thank you for your tolerance of that long first section. I had to get that out of me. I had to get it out. So, in that first long talk, a couple of comments were interjected that I just sort of walked right away from because I was on my own little path. And one of them came down to, how is it that some people have an experience like this? How is it? And I put to that maybe a sub-question. Not only how is it, but how common is it? Or, in negative form, how uncommon is it? Vision. Does anyone have inclination to speak to that subject?
Put my foot in right off the bat.
So go for it.
Well, it strikes me that one of the things that all of these people have in common, I'm guessing, is they're very, very bright and they're very, very sensitive. Now, they may be sensitive as a result of these early childhood things, that kind of stuff. And I think they're creative. They have those characteristics, and I'd be willing to bet that all of them were lonely children.
I think think of it as a capacity, a capability of being able to do this. Whereas some people would not be able to develop that capacity.
Not be able to develop?
Or let it happen.
It's
or let
just
it happen.
An openness.
Yes, just an openness.
I think they can't help it.
Can't help it.
I think it just
happens. It just happens.
And when I say lonely, I don't mean that they're wallflowers or something, but their experience is so unique that they can't really talk about it.
It is by nature isolating.
Yeah.
Their nature by nature isolates them.
Yes, yeah, separates. That would be my guess.
How common is it?
Not very.
Huh?
Not very.
Not very.
How many Jungs are there in the world?
Yeah, well, there was one Jung. Hell of a lot of Jungians.
A rhetorical question.
So if this requires that you go on... Okay, I heard a long time ago that 1 in 10,000 may actually go through individuation. I don't know where that came from. But
neither do I, but...
So... If part of Jung's theory of individuation is that descending to hell,
yes,
then you get 1 in 10,000.
Okay, you know, it's like the biblical use of numbers.
Yeah.
1 in 10,000 in a biblical sense would mean not very many, you know. Or when we talk of 40 days and 40 nights, you know, they're magical numbers. I guess 1 in 10,000 would mean.
But how do we come to know these people that it might be more common?
Huh? Or how do they let themselves be known?
We need a few more people here.
I don't think it's that rare.
Okay.
I don't think it's that rare.
I'm not even a guest.
Because I would say with the people that I've talked to, it's not infrequent that people have had some kind of spiritual experience.
Yes.
That maybe they rarely, if ever, talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it may be induced by great stress or the death of someone close to them or illness or whatever. But I think if they feel that there's a receptive ear, that it won't be judged, that I don't think it's that uncommon.
And perhaps they went on to experience outstanding success in other areas not related to philosophy or psychology, and so we don't associate them with that kind of experience.
Or perhaps they accomplished absolutely nothing and sat in their room pondering.
Yeah.
Having visions. I had training, when I talked one day, in guided imagery, and it's a process that, in this training anyway, that I learned to help the individual achieve a state of deep muscle relaxation and then allow an image to form. They go into almost like a trance, but you keep contact by verbally. And they can communicate with the image, and it can be very inspiring to them, and it can also provide a way toward finding some kinds of issues within their personality that they aren't able to achieve consciously, but they can in this deep state of relaxation.
So you're speaking in a psychological third-party voice, third-person
yes.
voice.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Would you say that people who have never had such a thing available to them ever in their life before, with that sort of training and help, can make it or allow it available?
I think it's possible.
How do some people indeed have great difficulty and find it unable?
Who were attracted to that mm-hmm. were already sort of into that.
Sort of crazy to start with.
Sort of crazy, but yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was quite a natural experience for me.
Might meditation provide a gateway to that?
Sure.
Azzagioli, the transpersonal guy, talked a lot about
who?
I think it's Azzagioli was his last name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Azzagioli. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He identified, you know, an existential crisis that occurs that leads to spiritual experiences, and I think that if you you can see that in AA literature, and I think the more common example is watch Pentecostal worship. They'll set a cultural expectation that you should be able to speak in tongues. And a lot of them identify that as a spiritual dialect, right? A direct communication with God. But I think we tend to be pejorative about that when we watch this.
You see, I was responding to the question, how many of them put it in for I think probably all of us have all kinds of spiritual experiences, This is a different journey.
Yeah,
I think.
I mean, you know, qualitatively and quantitatively, it's extraordinary. It is extraordinary. So let me step back and maybe comment on a couple of those things you just said, and then see how you respond. Okay, how often does it happen? Well, as was said, Jung, how many are there? How many are there like that? How many are there like that? My answer, not many. But some. This man was not one of a kind. If he was one of a kind, we would have no kind for the one other than Jung, right? Okay. That's the problem with being what they say sui generis. You know, being the only one of a genre of a. If you're the only one of the species, it ain't much of a species. You can't say anything about it except there's one. Jung repeatedly in his writings talked about the problem of statistical evaluation of human experience. That we are not statistics. That no matter what is common, or even uncommon, but within two standard deviations of some mean, there are exceptions in human experience. And, well, when I read those sorts of comments, because if he's really talking about in a critique of psychologies that look at statistical variation or at statistical models to define the natures of human experience, Jung knew he was an outlier, right? Jung was not on the bell curve. He was not in two standard, three standard deviations of the mean. He knew he was way out there on the edge, that his experience was not common. Rare, yeah, more than rare. Okay, so here this guy is. We're just talking about this all during the break. And this stuff is happening to him in the Red Book. As he says there at the beginning, he's talking to his soul, and the soul says, you know, go down. And he says, how do I descend? You know, you need to go to the other world. Well, I know of no other world. The man did not know what was happening. He didn't have a guide there with him to start with at all. He was simply facing what he had been forced to face. Now, there had been inclinations towards visionary material earlier in his life, most certainly. He had read about Swedenborg and Nietzsche, who, of course, ended in insanity. Nietzsche was a warning case, right, for Jung. And Goethe, who he felt very close to. He felt that Goethe's literary work, poem of Faust, was just that sort of hermeneutic of a real vision. He felt that Goethe, who worked on Faust up until his dying day, the old man Goethe was working on the second part of Faust in 1831, really at the threshold of his death, trying to finish it. It was the second part. That was the last major work of his life. And Jung felt that he really was trying to vest vision with form of word. So, when this was happening to Jung, don't you think one of the questions he was asking himself was, how often does this happen? Well, he knew that it happened to psychotic patients. My God, the man had been a resident, lived in the insane asylum, the Bergholzli, 9 years. He lived in the Bergholzli in the hospital with the patients. He ate with them. He interviewed them every day, did rounds. Knew some of these patients for years and years and years and listened to their psychotic babble for years and years and years of some of them. He knew what psychosis was. And he knew that in psychotic states, one could have visions, delusional material, mythic even, sometimes material come up. That wasn't what he was doing, you see. He was keeping his feet on the ground during at least the daytime of his life. And then trying to evoke fantasy. As he says, the same thing that the mad do. So here you have this guy doing this, and he's asking, what's going on? Who has this happened to? Where did he look for answers? In the records of humanity. He looked in the records of humanity. He read during this period, again, and he had read him in his student days, Nietzsche. He had read Goethe's Faust as a boy, I think, in his teenage years. His mother had given it to him and told him he should read it. And he'd felt immediate and deep sympathy with Faust, with Goethe's work. But you see, all of a sudden, Jung was reading the literature of the world with a very keen eye and ear, tuned to see and hear evidences of his experience, somehow veiled in form, interpretive form of word. So I mentioned Dante here in this first part of this talk. While Jung was writing while he was experiencing what he was experiencing and writing it down in his black book journals in 1914, he turned to Dante to read the Inferno. And as I mentioned in this preceding talk, the interpretive mode he then brought to his reading of Dante was extraordinary. It stood outside the literary critical mold of a common exegesis, a common hermeneutic, a common poetic reading of Dante. It was not Dante reforming Thomist theology. That is, of course, I mean, that really is a very common approach to Dante. I think it was quoted in the stuff that Paula handed out here about Dante, that his poem was essentially a recapitulation of you know, Thomas Aquinas' Catholic theology, Orthodox theology. Jung read Dante while he was going through this inferno. And what he saw is a man going through the inferno. A man having an experience like his experience. But then, of course, you see, you have the experience, and if you have it intensely and perpetually, as opposed to a single glimmering of something spiritual, and then are forced with a second task of bringing vision to form. That's a very difficult situation to be in. Then you see you're involved in what I'm talking about here as a hermeneutic, an interpretive art. But what are you interpreting? You're not interpreting another man's text. That's the classical use of the word hermeneutics is found in Christian theology. Hermeneutics is the art of reading the Word of God, of interpreting Scripture. And so, you know, they're in Orthodox, particularly conservative evangelical groups, the Bible is only read really in one hermeneutic mode: literal history. Right? I mean, God made the earth in 7 days, and Noah took every animal on earth onto that ark, and it rained a lot. That is a literal reading, but that is a literal biblical hermeneutics. The fact that the ark would have been sunk by the insects of this world alone, we leave that apart. It's just the mystery of God in the literal reading of God. So, you see, there is that literal hermeneutic. And then, of course, there's a moral or an allegorical. And this plays in Origen and in early Christian hermeneutics. You find already in this sort of allegorical approach to the Scripture that it's not just literal history, but there's an allegorical and an ethical meaning encapsulated there. But once again, the hermeneutic that Jung is now bringing to Dante is quite apart from that. He's not looking at the text for its moral or allegorical implication, or for its literal and historical account, relation of fact. He's trying to read the vision behind it. And that's what I mean by a horizontal axis in hermeneutics, that first literal, allegorical, moral, ethical, that stays very much in our realm of sociological experience, of human experience, in an outward way. Being shattered by this fourth type of hermeneutics, which is called anagoge, lifted up hermeneutics, the vertical axis that splits. And it is Jung's reading of literature here that is central to his exegetical project with his psychology, his writings, his work. So he's reading Dante in a way not so common, a way that was occasionally hinted at in commentaries over centuries, that Dante was actually having a vision and relating in form vision. So when he looked at he looked at alchemical literature, right? And people read this alchemical literature for years and years and thought, my gosh, this is very strange stuff. It's a precursor to chemistry. It's very, very superstitious. It's, you know, bunk because they didn't understand any of the real principles. What Jung said is, look, the alchemists were looking at a mystery. They were mixing various elements and things in their retorts, in their alembics, and putting those little pots on flames and sitting there watching. As a result of their experiments, their solutio and coagule, you know, dissolving and coagulating and dividing and compounding, they did actually develop some knowledge of the substance of matter. But for the most part, they didn't understand the elemental facts. And so they'd sit there in their retort, they'd look in there, and all of a sudden they'd see that things were turning orange. And then they would see, my God, it looks like an orange dragon. And then, oh my gosh, it's whitening. And scales have formed on the dragon. And the dragon is eating its own tail. Was that happening in the retort? No. What were they seeing? They were projecting their own imaginative vision onto the unknown. If... Okay, this is another story. Once upon a time, I decided I was going to walk through Wales when I was in my 20s. Okay, as my family home, I was going to go to my great-grandfather's home in Bethgelert, North Wales, and I was going to walk the coast of Wales. And I got stuck up in Carnarvon, in the north, and Bethgelert, the little village where my great-granddaddy left in 1848, is, I don't know, 20 miles south, something more than that. And darkness came, and I was planning on hitchhiking back to, because this was in the days when I only hitchhiked. I was too cheap to spend money on things like buses, you know. And so I walked, got out to the edge of Carnarvon, and I put my thumb out on this little two-lane road that went to Bethgelert, and no one stopped. And then not only did no one stop, there was no one to stop. And it got dark, really dark. In fact, it got night, really night. And then, well, you know, in Wales, you know, they say that you can always tell the weather in Wales. That if you can see the mountains, it's about to rain. And if you can't see them, it's raining. So it started to rain. The Welch clouds descended. It was a moonless night. It was so dark. So dark. How dark, Johnny? It was so dark that I could not see my hand in front of my face, my feet on the ground. I could not see the sides of the road. I could not see the road. And I had 20 miles before I slept to walk. So I started walking down this road. And the only way I knew I was on the road is when my feet started hitting dirt to the side, I knew I was off the road. After about 2 hours of this, and not a damn car came, drizzling dark. After about 2 hours of this, I started to hallucinate. What's that? You know, this is Bethgelert. This is the home of Welsh witches. And I was becoming terrified. But terrified because things were... I was seeing things in the dark. This is long before Jungian psychology, folks. I mean, you know. And my, you know, as my little heart's going like that. And thank God, finally, after 3 hours, I saw a light in the distance of an inn. And the story ends there, that story. But you see, this is, I use this as an example. If you, and this same thing happens in sensory deprivation. If you put people in a sensory deprivation chamber, you know, float them in water and dark and quiet, what do? They hallucinate. Sometimes in 30, it only takes about 30 minutes before people start hallucinating. Right? So when you're looking into absolute darkness, sometimes you see. But what do you see? Not that, because that's absolutely dark. You see what's there, inside. Jung was suggesting that in the alchemical work, the alchemists were doing just that. They're looking into the unknown and projecting things in themselves. Okay, well, they're making it up. They're projecting things in themselves. Ah. But you see, folks, this is the key to Jung. Because he felt the stuff inside of us was shared stuff. The stuff inside of us, at a certain symbolic level, went into a collective and objective layer of consciousness or unconsciousness. And that some of the stuff they saw, well, there was some same sorts of stuff that would come up in religious, visionary material across the ages. They were working with a myth, their myth of matter. So Jung read the alchemical literature in this way, as a hermeneutics, an interpretation of vision. These folks had visions, and they were bringing to it an interpretive method. In Dante, there was a poem. In the alchemical literature, well, if you read it, it's very allegorical, metaphorical, but another word, symbolic. A great number of symbolic drawings come out. And in the symbol, Jung felt that there was a deep expression of the primary experience of the inner archetype. So here you have Jung in the early part of his journey with the Red Book and throughout, you know, the next years, looking actually for examples. Now, I said there weren't many, but Jung started seeing that, my gosh, there were. Jung started reading during this period, before this period actually, before he wrote Symbols of Transformation in 1912. He had been studying mythology and he'd been studying religious documents, religious history. And he found in the documents of the patristic scholars, the early Christian writers, tales about heretics of the early Christian centuries who they called Gnostics. And the heresiologists had, been highly critical of the heresy, and in their criticism of it, in their attack on it, they very often told the stories or recounted the myths or the theological doctrine of the Gnostics. Jung got very interested in this stuff because when he read it, he saw that in this mythology of Gnosticism, there seemed to be a primary symbolic material to which he found relationship. These sorts of plays of light and dark, of a Christ within, of, you know, all this sorts of stuff was there. And he felt that these individuals had been early psychologists, people willing to explore the visionary realm and to replicate it. In fact, this is one of the criticisms that Irenaeus, one of the great patristic heresiologists, fighter of heresy, wrote in his great book Adversus Heresias, is that that these people, the Gnostics, they make up new myths every day. None of them think they're mature until they too are making up a myth, having a vision and writing it down. Now Jung thought, my gosh, that sounds like, you know, that sounds like something that an analyst would be asking his analyst ends to do. And then they're analyzing it and bringing a hermeneutics, an interpretive layer to primary vision. So Jung was finding evidences that what had happened to him was not alien to human experience. It was a rare human experience, but not alien. He was not an only one. Now, Dr. Shyam Dasani is about to publish a book. It'll be available in America at the end of this month, called C.G. Jung, A Biography in Books. And what Dr. Shyam Dasani has done over the years is actually sat in Jung's library and gone through every one of the books on his shelf and looked at the places he outlined things, where he made marks, how he used quotations, things that he put in the books. And in this biography of books that I was able to get a copy of when I was in Geneva, he really emphasizes a certain type of literature that Jung was reading during this period. You know what it is? Visionary literature. And it includes people like Rider Haggard and a book called She. That was very important then. Or there's an Austrian author by the name of Gustav Meyrink who wrote some very fantastic types of stories. He was interested in that sort of stuff. And Blake, he was aware of Blake. He was ambivalent about Blake. He felt Blake took his vision too much to art and not enough to, perhaps, to insight.
How about William James?
James, this is, now here you hit the key. And this is on a slightly different subject level. But James really stands as a scientist. William James was at Harvard, one of the first psychologists in America, wrote the first textbook of psychology, which was published, I think, in 1890. He worked on it forever to publish it. James was a very influential figure. But Eugene Taylor, a prominent scholar of James, particularly of James, at Harvard, and Sonu Shyam Dasani had been arguing for decades, is that the critical influence on C.G. Jung, young Dr. Jung, was not Freud. I mean, Freud was an episode. Freud was a misadventure for Jung. Jung's intellectual roots, Eugene Taylor and Sean Dasani have argued in many scholarly publications, was William James. William James and Jung were very good friends. James wrote also The Variety of Religious Experience, a book that many of you may have come part of. He was interested in spiritual experience, religious experience, even parapsychological, spiritualistic experience, because he felt all of these, to some degree, were valid expressions of this inner dark mystery. So James was very important to Jung, as was another fellow by the name of Théodore Flournoy, a French fellow. And Flournoy and James were more important to Jung than Freud ever was. They belonged more to his intellectual history. Okay. All right, so I said hermeneutics of vision, a tradition of vision. Let me just amplify that a touch more, if I can. And this is key. I've used this term, and I actually, for the first time, I heard Sonu use this term in his talk at the Library of Congress. I was quite amazed to hear him use that term, and happy, because it makes sense. Jung had this visionary material, and he was then involved with what I would call a hermeneutic effort, as had others across history. He took the vision and he brought it to form. And this happened in layers, one might say. One might discriminate a variety of phases in his development of his visionary material. When it all started in November 12th of 1913, the man did not know where it was going, how far it was going, how deep it was going, why it was going. It was just starting. And he was quite naive about the process, about what would happen at that point. He was simply letting what happened happen and taking notes. There's a whole lot of stuff I would like to talk to you about, but I'm not going to tonight, it's too late. But by January of 1913, he had several visions of a coming of war. There's one particular section of Liber Segundus in the end of the ninth wandering that I was going to read to you tonight. It's called The Three Prophecies. You really have to read this. Jung really had a vision of the coming of war. The Three Prophecies. But it was a vision of the coming of war. He didn't know what it meant until there was a war. Broke out. Until the great sacrifice began. That led to a second level of his hermeneutic. He'd kept his diary, the events. And then the second level broke loose. After the war started in 1914, all of a sudden he saw that what had been happening to him was not entirely personal. It was not only about his personal issues. It was not about his personal disintegration, the psychosis. He had been sensing more general elements in the collective psyche of his time and bringing them to form. So then the second level of the hermeneutics comes and he writes a draft. And in this draft, he now adds that commentary layer. He's actually making an interpretation of the original visionary material in that second layer. That's finished. It's 1,000 pages of handwritten stuff. And then he gives this to Tony Wolfe. She types it. And then starts a third layer of his hermeneutic, of his interpretive effort to bring vision. Now, you have to understand, go back. This starts as if it were a dream, experienced in full awakeness. Okay? He's brought verbal form to what happened. Some of it was visual, like that descent to hell. What did he see? He tells you about what he saw. He saw a young girl pinned to the ground by three demons. Then he saw that one of the demons was leaning over her head, and then he saw that there was a silver fish hook that the little girl was holding stuck in the demon's eye. That was a vision. But he had to take that and write it. You know, interpret it. Bring it to word, just like you might have to do a dream. And if you've ever done this with a dream, you realize it's quite difficult to get to all of the details. But there is enough precision, detail, and intensity in these waking visions that he could fairly well transcribe them. Okay, that's layer one. Then the commentary, layer two. And then he says, I have to put it in a book. Now, again, he's working with the primary vision. And he's bringing this third layer of form And now, the hermeneutic involves actually an object of art. The calligraphy, the size of the page, the color of the ink, the illustration added, the nobility of text varies, highly noble and illuminated, to simply written. That is another layer of bringing a vision to form. Okay? And then after, you know, he's read the manuscript, he has the typescript, he works on this red book very intensely from about the time he started writing the parchment pages and then writing in the red book itself. That started around 1915. And he continued working on it really, really pretty intensely through about 1919, 1920. He was running off several pages a day. But then you get to about page 120 in the Red Book, of which there are 189 pages completed in the Red Book. You get about page 120, and he starts slowing down. The visionary material is slowing down, too. He's really moving on in his hermeneutic. And he never finishes the transcription. Throughout the 1920s, after about 1922, it slows down. He's only doing a few pages a year at the end. And then in 28 to 30, he's done. And he has not even gotten through the second part of Liber Novus. He has a third manuscript called Scrutinies that he hasn't even begun transcribing. Never would. And then at the end of his life, in maybe the 5-10 years before he died, he felt this need to go back and try to finish the book. He knew he had left it undone, and at the end of his life, he felt he had to finish it. So he pulled out his manuscript, and in his aged hand, on those last pages, after about page 160 or so, 165 through 189, you'll see the hand gets quite aged. This is Jung in his old age trying to finish the work that he had not finished. And at the very end, you'll see he has outlined, illuminated initials and things that he was going to paint that he never painted. And it ends in mid-sentence. He turns the page, and then he writes his epilogue in his normal handwriting. He writes his epilogue. This is a book I started, etc., etc. You can read it there. That page is reproduced in the facsimile. He's done. Okay, a primary hermeneutic. Jung is taking vision and bringing it to form. Verbal form. Objective form in a book, a precious book. And in the book, illustration, color. All the illustrations in the Red Book, those things, you see, because he was transcribing the book over 10, 15 years, those illustrations at the beginning are related to the text. In the first 8 or so folio sheets, they're very much related to the text. But very soon thereafter, the images themselves have hardly any or no relation to the text. He's transcribing the text, and new images are coming from them, and this new layer of development in the pictures is coming out of him. And he's putting that into the Red Book. This is what I would call Jung's primary interpretive work, his hermeneutics, his action as Hermes, as the connecting point, the messenger between above and below. Hermes, the messenger of the gods. Jung is in that role, as Philemon told him he would be. In 1915, Philemon told Jung, Hermes is your diamond. By 1928, it's done, as much as it's going to be done. And you know what Jung decides? He can't show it to anybody. Who would understand a primary interpretive effort centered on vision? The pictures, the text is madness. And as he says in that epilogue, and so it would have been if I had not brought to it, if I had not brought to it consciousness and understanding. At this point in Jung's career, something new starts. He has had an experience of primary vision. He has given it a hermeneutic effort, an interpretive effort. Now a second layer of his work, his life work, comes. He knows what it is to have vision. He knows what it is to bring it to form. Now he must find evidence of others of this fact in history. He must document that he is not the only one. Not only that he's not the only one that's had the experience, but he's not the only one that in his hermeneutic effort has discerned similar symbolic motifs, seen similar symbols, and even, well, understood things like heaven and hell, and Christ and Antichrist. And the fact of a fact within humankind, seeking expression. That is the second layer, and you could call this a secondary hermeneutics. I would prefer to call it an exegesis, simply to differentiate it from this primary interpretive work. I'd call it an exegesis, a method of going back across history. You see, but now his interpretive method is informed by his experience, you see. So now when he reads Dante, as he had been doing when he was writing the Red Book, he reads in a hermeneutic mode that is entirely alien to most other, certainly to the literary, historical, critical, sociological, Freudian, French linguistic schools of academy. It ain't that. It's anagoge. It's the fourth hermeneutic method, the elevated method. And so now he's reading Dante in a completely different way. He's looking at Blake in a completely different way. This was the issue, because Blake was actually having visions. His books are visionary books. But, you know, for 100 years, no one could make hide nor hair, head nor tail, a Blake, until along comes Northrop Frye, a brilliant man, a brilliant literary critic, in the late 1940s, and says, you know what? You want to understand Blake? What you have to understand is Blake was having visions. More or less, that's what Northrop Frye forwarded, and Harold Bloom subsequently caught on. That this is a hermetic, Kabbalistic, visionary, Gnostic work, Blake. So Jung brought his interpretive mode to his exegesis of history. He brought it to alchemy, because he felt alchemy was the connecting link between an ancient form of this, which has existed in Hermeticism and Gnosticism. These are categorical words, but they really refer to a group of people who were ennobled by a hermeneutics of vision. Traditions defined, not by text being passed on, not by even oral transmissions being passed on. What sustained the tradition? Vision itself. In the tradition, you were expected to have vision. And the tradition existed to help you there. Oh, my. That sounds a little bit like Jungian psychology. Oh, my. We're supposed to have dreams, active imaginations, and then we're supposed to think about them. We're supposed to see what the primary symbol formation comes out of our experience of the inner realm. Gosh, sounds a lot like Carl Gustav Jung. You see, that's what he was doing, looking at history. So his exegesis, as you read Jung's collected works, he continually goes back to these signal points, these signal individuals, and tries to show science that what happened to him happened to others. Except. He's never telling you what happened to him. He's not showing you the primary hermeneutics, his red book. People close to him, a dozen, knew. People sort of close, 50 or so, knew some. No one got the whole story. Ladies and gentlemen, it took 50 years after the man's death before the whole story of what happened to Jung has been made and will be made fully available. You are the first people, the first real generation of people who can finally look at this man and the flow of his life's work and make critical, informed assessments. Assessments have been made, like Dieter Baer's biography. It's huge. There are some really interesting footnotes in there, and it is full of shit in some chapters. She just skipped over this entire section of his confrontation with the Red Book. She did. Well, why did she skip over it? She didn't have any of the documentation. I mean, she didn't go looking hard enough, but if she would have looked, no one would have given it to her. The Red Book was hidden. The Black's Book were hidden. She gave one chapter to that, and it's full of errors, even errors that were obviously able to be corrected. there are chapters that are like other chapters that are quite good. She was a good researcher, but she just didn't understand. And that's been true of much of the biographical material written by everyone except a few disciples of Jung who heard the story in part from Jung himself, like Barbara Hanna, like the great African scholar and writer and soldier Lawrence Vanderpost, the most blessed man. So you see, this hermeneutics of vision is very important. It was important to Jung as the primary fact of his life, and it was the sustaining chain that led his exegesis across history. And it was the fact at the center of his psychology. Because Jung knew that no one would understand the psyche without meeting the psyche. No one would accept the reality of a hermeneutics of vision unless they had touched vision. And so, people came to him. Some were ready. Some were ready to go, and some were not. Those who were not, he helped as best he could, as a good therapist should, and pushed no further. Some were ready, and he opened for them doors. His criteria for becoming an analyst was not passing the test on the Myers-Briggs assessment or anything else, as it is now. His criteria, and it could come after just 3 months or so of meeting with him daily, or 6 months or a year, was that you had met the psyche and knew it was real. That knowledge in hand, you could be a guide and a help in this world. So I will not get into any of the remaining 22 pages unless anyone want to stay. No, you don't want to stay. I knew. Okay, forget it. So thank you very much. We'll talk again next week. And we'll talk again next month, and I will talk about Philemon, and maybe a little bit of three parts. I'll talk about the Philemon, seven sermons, and then I'm going to talk about Jung and the new Aeon, the new age of Aquarius. You have to wear tie-dyed shirts, flowers in the hair, and somebody has to bring the soundtrack for the Age of Aquarius. Is that okay? All right.